guys, and welcome to episode 243 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, this is a story episode I recorded with Ian Johnson. Ian is a former professional basketball player, and in this episode, he shares his OCD story, homosexual and relationship-themed OCD, his childhood experiences, feeling suicidal, playing professional basketball while experiencing OCD, superstitious thinking, getting therapy, opening up and talking about his pain with a therapist, exposure and response prevention therapy, words of wisdom for athletes with OCD, feeling connected with others with OCD, mindfulness, his book, The Bounce and the Echo, words of hope, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy this episode. I hope there's something in it that you find useful. I really appreciate my time with Ian. Before we get into the episode, a quick word from our podcast partners, NoCD. NoCD are dedicated to creating a better everyday life for people with OCD by making care more accessible, more connected, and more effective. To connect with one of their OCD therapists, schedule a 15-minute free confidential call with NoCD's intake team. To find out more, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. Thank you as always to NoCD for supporting the show, and thanks to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Ian Johnson. On the podcast today, I have Ian Johnson, who has kindly agreed to share his story with us and talk about his book, The Bounce and the Echo, Dying to Love a Game. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Stu, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here, man. And I first met you in Austin, I believe. I think that was the first place I met you. And geez, that was last year, was it?
I think it was just about a year ago. Our 1 year anniversary is coming
last,
up.
Last July. It seems like about 5 years ago now to me. Isolation screwed me up. But let's get started with your story. So in as little as much detail, it'd be good to hear that.
So my OCD story starts when I was about 9 or 10 years old. There's always been a pretty much direct correlation between stressful, traumatic situations in my life and the quantity, frequency, and intensity of my OCD symptoms. So the first symptom I can ever remember having knocked on the door of my life and showed its not so pretty face when I was just about to start fourth grade, nine or 10 years old. And the start of fourth grade was just when my family moved from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Charlottesville, Virginia. And we arrived at our new house sometime early in the afternoon. And my sisters and I, we were all kind of nervous and uncertain. My dad opened the front door and we all walked inside. My mom told me and my sisters, go upstairs and check out your new rooms. And as I was making my way up the steps in this new home for the first time, I noticed a dead bug on the second step up. And this is an image that I can still pretty easily recall to this day. It was this dead bug on the left side of the step. It was on its back. And I remember being quietly freaked out by this dead bug. And literally, like in that second, something which had not been real in my life was now exceptionally true. And this dead bug seemed very ominous in a vague but really powerful way. It represented something bad. I didn't know what the bad thing was. And then so by association, that second step then began to represent something unclear but something bad. And so I proceeded to avoid that step for basically as long as I lived in the house. And that was my first real symptom that I can remember. And then as I got older, I began to play basketball and I started to experience some other types of symptoms. And these symptoms would be relatively benign compared to what would come later, but they were mostly associated with my fingers and taking my thumb and touching it successively against the fingerprint of my other fingers, and then making Spock from Star Trek type motions with my hands, kind of like I was making a Pac-Man chopping motion. And I would do this during games, before games, and there was always the feeling that if I didn't make these motions with my fingers, then something bad would happen to my mother or we'd lose the game because I didn't make these motions. And they weren't overwhelming at the time. They were just kind of something confusing that I did and that I was largely able to hide. And then as I got a little bit older, again, I started developing nighttime rituals. And this is when things started to get a little bit more scary. And the nighttime rituals were based around going to bed at a certain time. And usually that time was 20 or 25 minutes past the hour, but it could have been any time. And I had to notice the time on a certain watch. And then as that time approached, I had to go through a certain, preparatory ritual, which involved sitting in bed a certain way and flipping through a magazine a certain way, looking at the right page in the right way a certain way. And then for anyone who's familiar with OCD, you know, there's no exact way. It's just when your brain gets the signal that it's right. And then that's the point in which I went to the bathroom. And then hopefully when I came back, I was able to go to sleep. And if I was, I went to sleep. And if I was, something wasn't right, then I would have to repeat the ritual, sometimes waiting another hour or two until the time felt right. And then that was a pretty regular ritual up through high school. And then these were relatively benign and just scary and a little bit anxious and definitely confusing, but that didn't seem to derail my life the way my later symptoms would. And then when things really started to change was when I turned 18, I went to a boarding school for my senior year of high school. And at this boarding school, towards the end of the year, I began dating another student in the spring just before graduation. And I pretty much went gaga over this girl. And you can take all the cliches about first love, teenage love, and then lump them all together and then spark that with the flame of obsessional OCD, and you get my first real attachment to a woman. And we dated for a couple months, and then when school ended, because this was a boarding school, we both went back to our respective hometowns, and we talked on the phone for a couple weeks and made plans to see each other. And by this point, I was just obsessionally attached to her in a kind of a goodish way. And that, like, I was thinking about her obsessively, but I didn't have overwhelming symptoms associated with her. It was probably unhealthy, but it was heavy. But then, after a couple of weeks, I was pretty attached to her, but I guess you could say she wasn't all that attached to me, because just one day, randomly, when I thought things were good, she stopped returning my calls. And no explanation, no goodbye, nothing. Ghosting wasn't a term back then, but in today's terminology, she basically ghosted me. And I was devastated without knowing how to tell anyone or even to acknowledge to myself how heartbroken I was. And because I couldn't admit even a single iota of sadness or confusion to myself, the OCD said, don't worry, Ian, we got this. And then there was this kind of not immediate, but just this kind of gradual increase in symptoms. And like, all of a sudden, by the end of that summer, there was a lot of exciting things happening. Like, I was going to college and I was going to play basketball at a really good school. But there was also this slow burn of an increase in my anxiety and the superstitions I had and the fear I had about talking to women. And my nighttime rituals began to be more intense, and it was a lot harder for me to fall asleep. And then from about that point, 18, until got to be 26 and finally collapsed from utter exhaustion of OCD for those 8 years. It was my OCD was very regular and usually super intense, and that, so I was, suicidal for most of those years, and the suffering was just to the point where killing myself seemed like the only way to relieve it.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing. And what I get, what kind of turned things around for you?
So then I played 4 years of college basketball and then 5 years of basketball in Europe for teams over where you live, Stu. And once I started playing basketball at these higher levels, the basketball's, the pressure of such a sport and trying to compete at a high level constantly, and living in an environment that wasn't really conducive to sharing the weird things in your head, my symptoms continued to increase. I had superstitions that, one time I tried to list in a day what all the superstitions I had, and I couldn't even get through 5 minutes before getting super freaked out about like how many there were. I was superstitious about almost literally any movement or thought that I had. So let's say I was playing in Hungary and I would drive the 10 minutes from my apartment to the gym for practice. I would be superstitious about the time, the number time, the minute that I left my apartment. I would be superstitious about the route I took, even if I took the same route every day, the way I held my hands on the wheel, the thoughts I had about holding my hands on the wheel, the spacing of my car between other cars, what types of cars I passed, the pace of my walk from the parking lot to the gym door, how I stepped into the arena, what I was wearing, who looked at me first in the locker room, how I sat down in my locker, how I changed into practice clothes, what I was thinking about when I changed into practice clothes. And this list is getting exhausting, but it's really just kind of a fragment of like just how almost everything I did was just related to basketball was associated with a superstition. And then, sometimes when I was on the court, I was very grateful that these superstitions would kind of recede, especially, if we were winning a game or I was playing well and I could kind of relax. But a lot of times during game plays, even during big games, I would continue to experience these OCD symptoms, like not stepping on certain lines or not moving to certain areas of the court. And as any basketball player will tell you, sometimes you just got you got to step on certain lines and you got to move to parts of the court. And my I was just deadly scared of telling anybody about this. So thankfully that my desire to hide my symptoms from everyone else weighed more than the impulse I had not to venture into a certain area of the court. And so I was able to hide things, but the superstitions were just incredible. And then finally, my fourth year playing, I was getting ready to go to practice. And by this point I had been, the overwhelmingness and the exhaustiveness of the symptoms had driven me to consider suicide for years, including a couple attempts. And I was getting ready again to reach that mental crossroads at which you either, obviously haven't killed myself, but I imagine like you get to that crossroads and you're either going to kill yourself or you're going to get help. And I remember kind of collapsing on my kitchen floor and as I was getting ready to leave, and I was just like, I cannot do this anymore. And then I'm very grateful I had a big sister who I felt comfortable enough saying, like, can you recommend a therapist? And I didn't tell her why. And I didn't really even know that I had OCD at the time. But I said, can you recommend a therapist? And she did. And that was when things kind of started to change. When I started talking to that therapist, it was as if I was just this humongous box and someone took the tiniest needle and just stabbed like the most hidden part of the box, but it was enough for a little air to get into the what had been stagnated environment for so long. And that really helped in terms of putting me on a different path.
No, thank you for explaining that. And yeah, it's hard not to go to different parts of the court when you're running plays and stuff and you have to move. And so, yeah, my question was going to be, were your coaches getting mad at you? But like you said, you the fear of telling people was greater than the parts of the courts you kind of were able to hide it. What was my question?
I will say, like, I definitely bewildered a few of my coaches at some point. And there were some times when we'd be watching tape of a game and I would see myself, particularly with the half court line. So some of the lines down by the basket, it's harder to think about. But when you run from one side of the court to the other, there's, you know, a second or two of freedom when you can think. And so watching tape, sometimes I would see myself kind of hiccup my step so that I would avoid stepping on half court. But otherwise, you know, sometimes you just got to, it was almost a form of ERP and that, you know, I had to step on this line or else, you know, someone would find out, and often stepping on the line would, you know, kind of make me feel better in a way.
Yeah.
So it wasn't all horrible.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, and with the, I mean, the superstitions sound really exhausting. So what was the kind of the fears behind the superstition of, like, if you didn't do those superstitious things, what was the worry that was going to happen, the fear?
I mean, the immediate worry would be that I would not play well and the team would lose. And then the deeper worry would be an insecurity of who I was inherently, you know, kind of to myself. I had almost no sense of, or a very little sense of self-worth. And what I was doing with basketball was trying to, you know, prove to my coaches, prove to others, prove to, you know, my inner child who struggled for validation as a kid that, you know, I was a worthy human being. And so when basketball became the primary means through which I was going to accomplish this sense of self-worth, then without recognizing that, and without having other means in which I could, an internal means of validating myself, then you know, the OCD said, you know, we better make sure that you do well or else, you know, you're just going to be deemed unworthy and you will, no one will like you and everyone will call you names and they'll write bad things about you in the paper and all that stuff. And so, like, the immediate thing, the thoughts I had as it was happening was, I need to do these things so I can play good. The deeper subsurface things, which I didn't recognize at the time, would have been related to self-esteem and validation, self-validation.
Yeah, no, thank you for explaining. It makes a lot of sense. Okay, so you saw that therapist, and you were abroad at this time, right, when you first... starts.
Correct.
And
correct.
So were you doing sort of teletherapy? Or was it therapist abroad?
I mean, there were therapists abroad, but I didn't really speak all too good Hungarian. So.
Yeah, fair enough.
I knew practice de l'automne, and I knew practice de la hutte, which is practice in the morning and practice in the afternoon. Those were the couple phrases I knew. And then
that
a few other
help.
Words as well, but. Yeah. Wouldn't have gotten me far in my first sessions.
No, it wouldn't have. But so this therapist you saw, did they understand OCD, or was it just other stuff you got out of the therapy that helped initially?
No. So it was I didn't know anything about OCD. I didn't know. Eventually, my therapist kind of guessed, but. You know, I didn't know anything about ERP, and actually didn't even start practicing ERP until last year after the conference. I showed up at the IOCDF conference in Austin where we met, and everyone was talking about ERP, and I remember sitting there like, what's ERP? So I had to pull up my phone during this conference and kind of do a Google search. And it was, this the same way with so many of the symptoms that I experienced, like homosexual OCD. I didn't know what it was a thing until a long time. ROCD, I actually didn't really fully understand until I listened to the interview you did on your podcast, this podcast, with the Israeli doctor. And so there's just a lot of ignorance. But at the same time, which for any listeners who are experiencing ROCD, that is a great episode to get a better understanding of yourself. But so the therapist I had, he was a really great therapist, and he really did help alleviate my symptoms. And that for the first time in my life, I was talking, and it's hard to explain. I was just how relieving it was just to be able to say, like, hey, I'm hurting. Hey, I tried to kill myself. I want to kill myself pretty much every day. And to be able to share that with someone was exceptionally relieving, even if I wasn't directly practicing ERP.
I agree. I think when there's so much shame and you bottle it up for so long, mm-hmm. being able to talk to someone, especially someone who's trained to do this,
yes.
in a safe way, just to be heard and to be understood and not judged, is a huge mm-hmm. release of pressure, which makes
for
a world
sure.
of difference.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, no. Thank you for explaining that. And so you continued your career for a bit longer while doing the therapy, or were you coming to an end at that point?
Yeah, so I kind of came to an unwitting end. I didn't want to end my career, but therapy kind of opened this door into the ignorance I had of myself and the world around me in so many ways. And that became kind of my new avenue. And so I ended up playing one more year. It was actually a really good year, and I had a lot of fun playing. But at the same time, I was, really digging into therapy and, spending all my hard-earned basketball dollars on tens of thousands of dollars of therapy. But it was so worth it. And reading all these different books about the mind and about just the world in general, and just giving myself this freedom to try to really discover myself anew. It was an incredibly autodidactic period for myself. And unfortunately for my basketball career, I didn't know how to separate the two. So I ended up retiring after five seasons in what I now think was like a really premature way. And then from there, did a lot of continued on with therapy and self-exploration, and did a lot of traveling. And 10 years later, here I am, and I'm still in therapy and still working on myself. But and I still think it's sad that I'm not playing. I would probably still be playing if I had gotten help at 10 or 11 years old, as opposed to 25 or 26.
Yeah, no, that is sad. Yeah. And is that something you've addressed in therapy, in terms of like the loss of your career, or the premature ending?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of I experienced a lot of shame around that, and definitely a lot of regret of lost life. So if you think of my life, or if I sometimes think of my life as kind of like an X, and then the first 25 years of my life were the two ends on the bottom moving towards this cross in the middle. And then this cross in the middle would have been when I broke down in Hungary my fourth year playing, and when I first started seeing the therapist. And then the second half of my life is this expansion from that cross, the upper half of the X cross outwards. And when that upper half looks down at that first half, like there were a lot of really beautiful things that I experienced, but I didn't have a lot of things that I have now that I wish I would have had then, like self-awareness and, a much more a sense of peace with my symptoms and an understanding that I actually have OCD and things like that. And, I often feel really shameful as if it's, you know, it's life. Life is was being life for me. And like I recognize that all the influences that created my life, but at the same time, it's still hard not to feel shame that I missed out on things or, treated other people not the way I would have treated them if I had, known what ROCD was, for instance. And so on.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And thank you for going into it. I think the reason I asked it is because I'm sure a lot of the listeners could relate to that around that. The sort of, I think I've talked about before, like the grief and the mourning, the loss of the life or the years that was spent on OCD where they weren't fully lived or there was missed opportunities. And I think sometimes that gets missed. And I think it's a big part of many people's stories.
Yeah, definitely a big part of recovery too is I think learning to feel okay with that grief and to let go of the regret and the heartbreak of having lost so much of your life to a condition.
Absolutely, man. And are you coaching now? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, now I'm a basketball coach. I don't coach a particular team, but I work with a bunch of different players, different ages, different skill levels here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Nice. I mean, what a gift you can now bring to those players, whatever age they're at, to kind of guide them. Because whether it's a diagnosable disorder they have or just the struggles and pressures of trying to be the best they can be, I mean, you can bring a lot to them, through this pain and this suffering and this experience of OCD.
Yes, and I think obviously not everyone has OCD, but I think there's a lot of statistics that show how much young people are struggling. And I think I really hope I'm able to bring the memories of my experiences as a kid in the environment I wish I sometimes had as a kid that would have been more conducive to becoming myself, self-realization that is definitely coexistent with becoming a great basketball player. Yeah. And I really hope I'm doing that. That's for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. So I guess my next question then is just, if any athletes listening, be them professional or students, what advice do you have for them who may, let's say they've got OCD and they're also trying to be the best they can be in their sport?
So there's two things I would first talk about. And, obviously we just saying get therapy is a little bit too easy. But the first thing would be, addressing ignorance. So I was 26 when I first was officially diagnosed with OCD. And so that would have been almost 17 years after my first symptom. And there were a few times during those 17 years when I, was suspicious of myself and my relation to OCD, but I never, put the two together, if you will. But, when I did finally get diagnosed and I started, researching OCD, and even without practicing ERP, just the knowledge that here was this condition, it has a name, and here are some symptoms. Here's what homosexual OCD is. Here's what relationship OCD is. Here's what, all the other different types are. Here's what confessional OCD is. Here's what suicidal OCD is. Just knowing was such a huge relief. I still remember the internet search I did when I realized that both HOCD and ROCD were like real things that could be addressed. And it was just very relieving. So the first thing I would try to say is, do what you can to educate yourself. And whether that's through a therapist or, listening to a podcast or, reading a book, and it just really helps, and just keep doing it. And then I talked about listening to the, I can't remember the name of the Israeli doctor, Guy Doran. He was on the show, and I was listening to the podcast, and they were talking about ROCD. And then, for the first time, I was like, okay, here am I being described. It was almost like freaky. It was like, you guys were talking about me, but just really enlightening, and that, so that would be addressing ignorance would be one thing. And then the second thing would be, the loneliness of OCD. So as you mentioned, in 2019, I met you at the IOCDF conference, and, at one of the first sessions I had the first days, there was an early evening session, was a yoga class. And I attended this yoga class along with maybe 20 other people. And the yoga session was in this small ballroom-ish type room at in a corner of the hotel. And then we were spread out across the room. And, in my section of the room, while we were doing yoga, I could both see and hear a few of the other attendees experiencing OCD symptoms. And then when I looked at them, I could see what they were going through. And, for the first time since my very first symptom, I didn't feel alone with my OCD. And I was like, wow, these are my people. These are my peeps. And there's this kind of, camaraderie I felt in that yoga session, which I doesn't feel like I'll ever forget. I mean, here were people who understood. And then on another evening during the conference, I hung out with two people I'd met at another event, and we sat at one of the bars on, I think it's 6th Street in Austin, where everything gets crazy. But we went and sat at this bars and talked symptoms for like 2 hours. And this, really comfortable, but at the same time, brutally honest way. And there's just a lot of deep sharing. And again, there was this feeling of, wow, I'm really not alone with this. And, there are other people like me. And this was really significant because I'd felt alone with my symptoms for basically as long as I'd had them. And so now sometimes when I have a bad OCD day, I, can remember that there are other people out there who are experiencing what I'm experiencing. So in terms of the talking to the athletes out there, the locker room isn't always going to be a conducive place to share this, like the super weird symptoms that you have. But, if you can educate yourself and you can find a support group or, attend a certain event or something, like it really can be life-changing just to know that you are not alone and to be with other people who are like you. And you don't even have to say anything at these events. You can just kind of show up and just kind of experience the event and get the benefits without even sharing. So those would be my initial thoughts in terms of things I'd recommend to athletes.
No, thank you for sharing that. That's good advice. And I guess my other question was, so obviously therapy has been helping you. What else do you find that helps you kind of stay on top of it?
So as I answer this, I want to say that sometimes I get OCD about my OCD mitigating process. But the first thing that has been really helpful for me was, I feel incredibly privileged to have had like really good therapists, and so that has been first and foremost the tools that I've relied on to help keep myself okay. And then I experimented with diets, and I found that certain foods really helped me feel better, and getting enough sleep at night really helped. And then I think second to therapy, it always sounds a bit pretentious to say, but like my mindfulness practice has been exceptionally helpful as well. Just learning to, kind of sit with my thoughts and, just being there. And, I used, once I got into mindfulness, I changed the vocabulary that I use surrounding my OCD. So I considered it a major pivot point of mine when I stopped using the word fight to describe my relationship to my symptoms. Mm-hmm. So for the first dozen or so years that I experienced OCD, I was, exceptionally confused and terrified of what my mind could do, which was namely attack me. And in that bifurcated way that our minds work, one part of my brain ferociously fought against the OCD part of my brain, and the OCD part of my brain, it felt like, was just constantly attacking the non-OCD part of my brain. But what I eventually realized is that by fighting my symptoms and being so terrified of them, I was kind of giving them power. I was, if that makes sense, I was, kind of validating them in a way. So I eventually decided to incorporate words like acceptance and surrender into the self-talk I used with my OCD. And I'm definitely get a little self-conscious talking this way, but I began to operate under the mantras that, only love begets love. And then my other mantra was, you got to feel the heal, baby. So I was like, sometimes you got to feel the symptoms. And as hard and as scary as it was, I tried to, get to know my symptoms and invite them over for a cup of tea, as you Brits would say. And, I asked to listen what they might be trying to tell me. And then usually there was, conversation to be had. The symptoms were often related to something that was like really deep, or like my childhood, or like a traumatic event. But it, started with a conversation like, what's up, symptoms? How's it going? Like, you've been in my brain for a while and you've been causing a ruckus. Can you, tell me why? And then, however, paradoxically, learning to feel what needed to be felt and learning to hold my symptoms in like a more loving way actually really helped to alleviate those symptoms. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it does. Yeah. Yeah. No, I fully agree. I like the saying you just said, or mantra of, feel to heal. Is that right?
Gotta feel the heal, baby.
Feel the heal, yeah. I've often said, I think it was a Game Changers this March, gone, or maybe the one before, I think the year before, I kind of said about, I was talking about anger in my own journey, and I had to honor that anger and stop pushing it away. I was originally disgusted by it. I'm not an angry person, X, Y, and Z, when clearly I was, because I was feeling it. And it wasn't until I started to honor that anger and allow it and actually own it and say, yeah, in these parts, I'm angry. And feeling that has helped me work through it. But I had to feel it before it could go.
Is there anything you did to help yourself feel, or is just kind of something that happened?
Well, this came up in my own therapy. So it was more just over various sessions, it would keep coming back to the anger. And it was a process of me stopping resisting feeling it and just starting to... It was just through the conversations I have with my therapist that got me to the point that I finally kind of broke through and said, I am angry. And it took me ages to even own that. And as ridiculous as that sounds, but and then it became a bit easier, and then I could start to talk about anger more freely. And to now, I don't really feel shame around anger. I don't particularly want to feel it at times, but when it's there, I try my best to kind of be with it, not judge it, and allow it, as it's trying to teach me something in theory.
Well, I like the way you phrase that. It's trying to teach me something. I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and these emotions, there could people will say they're not teaching us anything, but then that may be the case. Who knows? But I'm going to learn something from it regardless. It's going to be a teachable moment for me. At least that's kind of the stance I've taken with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool, man. Right, where's my next question gone? So, let's hear about your book. You know, whatever you want to say about it, it'd be good to hear.
Sure. So my book is called The Bounce in the Echo, Dying to Love a Game. It is a part memoir, it is a part history, and it is a part what you might call a manifesto for youth sports in particular, but also sports in general. And I wrote the book, I think, for two very different reasons. The first reason is that I consider myself a citizen of Planet Sports, and you know, I love sports and continue to love basketball and you know, good competition, and good citizens are sometimes compelled to speak out. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to add my voice to the many voices already being heard, which are trying to normalize what needs to be normalized, and that is the acceptance of the full spectrum of human emotion in appropriate ways. And so hopefully my book does a little something in terms of that. You know, the second reason I wrote the book is that I think perhaps at a really deep level, I wrote it as a controlled way of showing people, namely my friends and family, that I was suffering and had been suffering for a long time. And this goes back to, you know, how hard it was for me and for so many others to you know, share that suffering with someone. So with the book, it was almost like I didn't have the courage to tell my friends and family straight up about the stuff I'd experienced. But with a book, I could control the narrative and I could say things and rewrite things until they were exactly as I wanted them to sound. And you know, so that's what I did. I didn't actually realize this as the book process was unfolding. And I've actually kind of only recently realized that this might have been an underlying reason for me writing the book, but it feels like it's legitimate. And then, you know, the more I've shared, the easier and healthier it gets to share. And, you know, hopefully the book can help athletes in particular, but, you know, other people who are struggling as well, just to hopefully find some avenues to get better.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes so people can go check that book out.
I appreciate it.
No worries, man. And yeah, I can completely relate to what you said about, you know, writing the book was a controlled way of kind of telling your story to the people close to you. And, you know, definitely with this podcast, you know, it wasn't until 18 months ago, maybe, or even, yeah, about 18 months ago that I finally kind of sat down with my own family and kind of discussed it with them. And I'd been doing the podcast at like for about 3.5 years at this point, because it was easier for me to tell strangers than it was the people who I grew up with but didn't notice or didn't I hid it from, you know. So
exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So it's weird, yeah. But like you said, it got easier, and that conversation for me was very, very cathartic and very healing.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like we've had these relationships with people, and the dynamics of the communication within the relationship are pretty ingrained. And so after so many years, to try to go back and to rewire what others think of us and the way we communicate with others, that's, you know, like you said, definitely pretty challenging.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's a good way of putting it. Okay. So, yeah, I guess when you did release the book, which was only last year, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yep. And I guess you gave copies to your family. How was it received? You know, because I'm guessing it was quite revealing in places.
I think there was a lot of confusion, and the first book event I had was here in Pittsburgh, and it was at this local bookstore, and there was, you know, my mom was there, and there's a lot of people who were really close to me were there. And, you know, a very limited number of them had any idea what was going to be in the book. And they had read maybe some, like a preview or something, but it was just this, you know, really, it was a super challenging. I was so nervous. But the reception, thankfully, was pretty good. So there was no one attacked me or anything. I think some of my former teammates in particular had some questions, and there was definitely a lot of confusion about what this means. The mental health narrative in general is definitely shifting, but there's still a lot of uncertainty and uncomfortableness surrounding it. Yeah. So there was definitely elements of some of that, but it was, you know, the people that wanted to ask questions, and the people that, you know, some people didn't even acknowledge the book, and that's, or acknowledge the subject of the book, and that was perfectly fine too. I think everyone has their own comfort level, but it was for me an exceptionally cathartic experience, and I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, no, it's great to hear. I'm glad it was well received, and obviously not an easy thing to release. Well, next question is just words of hope for people with OCD.
You know, I feel myself getting emotional even just thinking about that for 1 second. And the only things that seem to be coming to mind are cliches. Like it can get better. And the things I would go back to would be, you know, trying not to feel alone with what you're feeling. And because I think loneliness is as big a beast as the OCD sometimes. So I would just, anyone listening out there, you are not alone. It is so awful and can be so tough, but it is something that so many others are experiencing as well. And there are avenues out of it whenever you are ready.
Yeah, good way to put it. So you can pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self. What would you tell him?
I would tell him, you're okay, man. Like, it's okay that you're feeling these things. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that, you know, your whole life is going to be like this. And then I would tell him that, and then I would tell him, I tell him, shoot more 3-pointers earlier. Just kidding. I would tell him, you know, get your butt to see a therapist, a competent therapist who knows ERP and who knows how to address, you know, broader psychological areas as well.
Yeah. Nice. And then you've got a billboard in Pittsburgh. What do you want written on that billboard?
Breathe. I think breathe. Listen to your breath. Yeah. But actually, I think just breathe on that.
Yeah, I like that. No, important message. And then I guess lastly, is there anything else that you wish you could have shared today?
Am I allowed to say no?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I would definitely answer more questions, but nothing comes to mind in terms of things that I wish I could have shared. I thought you asked really, really good questions.
Well, appreciate it. And look, I appreciate you going into your story and talking about it from the athlete perspective as well. It's great to address that population on the podcast. And yeah, just to hear your story, hear about the book, I really appreciate it.
No, I really appreciate you having me on. I know you know, so many people listen to your podcast, and it's such a good support thing for so many people. And I'm appreciative. And like I told you, that ROCD podcast was really transformative, and I'm sure so many other podcasts are transformative for for others as well.
So there you have it. Thank you so much to you guys for listening. Thank you to Ian for his time. And all the links and resources will be in the show notes at theocdstories.com. And don't forget, today's episode is sponsored by NoCD. To find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy, it is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.